These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
Today, we explore maroons with Haile Gerima and Akinyele Emoju. But this book, we will shoot back, as well as examine the Black Church as an institutional physical space, our incubator of liberatory practice with deep-rooted African spiritual influences. This is Africa World Now Project. I am James Pope. Maroon derives from Spanish Cimarron. Cimarron originally referred to domestic cattle that had taken to the hills in Hispaniola. Soon after, it was applied to American Indian slaves who had escaped from the Spaniards. By the end of the 1530s, the word had taken on strong connotations of being fierce, wild, and unbroken, and was used primarily to refer to Africans and people of African descent, or runaways as they was once referred to. For more than four centuries, the communities formed by such escaped enslaved peoples dotted the fringes of plantations in the Americas, from Brazil to southeastern United States, from Peru to the American Southwest. Known variously as Columbos, these new societies range from tiny bands that survive less than a year to powerful states encompassing thousands of members that survive for generations, even centuries. Their descendants still form semi-independent enclaves in several parts of the Western Hemisphere, in Suriname, French Guiana, Jamaica, Colombia, and Belize. Maroon communities consisted of escaped peoples from a wide range of societies in West and Central Africa. At the onset, they shared neither language nor major aspects of culture. Their collective task was to create new communities and institutions through various processes of integrating cultural elements drawn largely from a variety of African ethnic groups. An example of this task is found in the political system of the great 17th century Brazilian Maroon community of Palmares, which is often being characterized as a new form of African state. For generations, historians believe that even the most remarkable of Maroon settlements in North America did not rival the achievements of Maroon communities in South and Central America as well as the Caribbean. Nevertheless, according to a number of scholars such as Cedric Robinson, Gerald Mullen, Neil Roberts, as well as Herbert Aptheker, evidence of the existence of at least 50 such communities in various places and at various times from 1672 to 1864 has been documented. Taken further back, Herbert Aptheker's work shows us that the first Maroon communities predated Jamestown settlements by 82 years. They were slave insurrectionists from abortive Spanish colonizing efforts in North and South Carolina. Maroon communities were a real presence in the U.S. Aptheker documented Maroon communities in Virginia, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, as well as Wake, Gate, Onslow, Bladen, Sampson, Jones, New Hanover, Dublin, Robeson, and Nash, to name a few counties in North Carolina. With this, we will listen to part of a discussion hosted by famed independent filmmaker, activist, scholar, Haile Gerima, and Dr. Akinyele Emoju, where they discuss Maroons and Dr. Emoju's book, We Will Shoot Back. Haile Gerima is an independent filmmaker and professor of film at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Born and raised in Ethiopia, Gerima emigrated to the United States in 1967 after the award-winning Ashes and Embers in 1982 and documentaries Wilmington 10, USA 10,000, 1978, and After Winter, Sterling Brown, 1985. Gerima filmed his epic, Sankofa, 1993. Gerima continues to distribute and promote his own films, including the most recent Teza, which won the Best Jury and Best Screenplay Awards at the Venice Film Festival in 2008. He also lectures and conducts workshops in alternative screenwriting and directing both within the U.S. and internationally. Dr. Akinyele Emoju is a scholar activist who currently serves as the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Georgia State University. Dr. Emoju's teaching and research centers on the history of people of African descent in Georgia, 19th and 20th century Black political and social movements, and African religion and philosophy. Dr. Emoju's writing has been featured in scholarly publications such as the Journal of Black Studies, Black Scholar, Radical History Review, and Socialism and Democracy, and in a number of edited volumes. He is also author of We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. Enjoy the program.
Documentary film we've been doing for 20 years, and it's about Maroons. It's Maroons are those runaways who did not have anybody's help but except their own feet, extricated themselves, run into swamps, mountains, hills, caves. We've been filming for 20 years. We were in the Great Dismal Swamp several times filming the archaeological activity American University professor is doing. We have been filming descendants who are reenacting this Maroon history from Manteon, North Carolina, all the way South Carolina to Fort Moseley. We filmed the reenactment of this history where black people not only ran away but created settlement. The most well-known one is Fort Moseley. And it's very interesting. A lot of historians do not know this, but, and I'm proud when I talk about this because I teach at Howard. But the first digging of this history was commissioned by Woodson Carter, sent Zora Neale Hairston to Fort Moseley and began to dig this history. Now many professors are into it. Archaeologists, historians, even politicians in Florida are in it. There's a major reenactment every year. And then we went to Brackettville, Texas, where these Africans who went from the region, I feel now I know the transportation. Even those Africans who were in the Great Dismal Swamp had gone through South Carolina, through time, they have ended in Florida, and they were in Fort Moseley, but also during the Seminole War, which is African Seminole part and the Indian Seminole War. They were, after the three wars, part of the Trails of Tears, the untold story where those black people who were part of this treaty, who were being transported into Oklahoma, Arkansas, etc., where they were subjected to snatchers. All kind of slave owners were coming to snatch people who have been away from slavery for over six generations, and then ended up in Oklahoma, dispute with Native American, contradictory friendship, alliance, contradictions. Then they had to escape again through Texas to Mexico. I personally have interviewed a brother who doesn't speak English, who only speaks Spanish, but his descendants, his genomics come from Florida, because he came during the September celebration of Seminole, Black Seminoles' descendants in Brackettville. He came. And what they do, we filmed them. This is what we filmed. They go to the cemetery one day, and this cemetery goes back 100 years. They touch the cemetery. They remember their ancestors. It's an amazing family. And these are descendants. Universities denied the history. Descendants kept it alive. The reenacting, going about their way, saying, we know where we came from. And so, in fact, there's a school in Brackettville, 100 years old school, Miss Charles built. She was the story designee, short storyteller of the Black Seminoles. She came herself through this Florida to the so-called Indian Territory, Oklahoma, Arkansas. She came through Texas, went to Mexico, and after the Civil War, she comes as a child from this descendants, from Mexico, back to Brackettville. And then she said, I don't want the world lose the history of my people. And she started to be the story designee storyteller. She, for years, she lived up to 95, 96. I missed her when I got there. She had passed, but she had designated a man called Woolly Warrior, who is now the storyteller designee. And so they pass it down. So we have this film. So part of this series of discussions we've been having for a whole three installments ends with Professor Akinyele, but begins again tomorrow with this writer, because she is right straight on what we are filming. And this we will film tomorrow, and I hope you'll make it at 4 o'clock tomorrow here with book signing of her books, etc. It's a very powerful title. I haven't read the book, but I know what she's talking about because I've lived it since the time I was making Sankofa. But anyway, and this brother today is not a stranger for Sankofa. He's come here last night. He made an amazing, he did a presentation. Professor Carr moderated the discussion and the lecture. It was an experience that I personally felt, even though I know this history, he's amazing. He's also a good storyteller. He doesn't, you know, give you facts and statistics, but really, he's a folklorist storyteller. He makes history palatable. That's what I liked about him. And I've been filming him when he was young, when he was older, and then he came on me. This time he came with his gray hair. I said, who's going to believe in this film to see this guy three times coming with different, beard? But it's part of the film. I'm glad I didn't finish it early. Personally, a lot of people say, you should have, why aren't you finishing the movie? I'm glad I didn't finish it because the story would have been shortchanged. We're getting the depth of the story for, you know, the length of time we're taking. So I just, without, you know, further ado, I want to present my brother, who I've known him when I was younger. And he was younger in California. Apparently today we found out we were at this place where Acklin Lynch was in California. And Acklin Lynch, you know, is a gold mine. So I was at UCLA. I was invited by this black group called The Gathering. Uh-huh. Okay? Survivalist maroon community, I would say, in the middle of Hollywood. And he came to speak, and I was like, this guy who just made a film, but everybody thought I must be really intelligent, so they asked me to speak, but I can't remember what I said, nor was I coherent, God knows. My English was all over the place, cross-eyed, and still it's cross-eyed. But I spoke in that event, and this brother was this young listener. Now he's this old lecturer here. And so I want to bring him to share with you a very, very, seriously, a very important maroon intellectual for me. Maroon intellectual. An intellectual who could have done other things. You know, it's like me. I could do a pornographic film, and a lot of black people would line up to go see. It's no big deal. It's simple to do, in fact, pornographic and kill each other. Movie is easy. The kind of movies we try to make, I hope, is, you know, makes sense, but it's difficult to even get financed. So the same thing with publishing. It's very hard to publish. It takes long for people to do. But today's book, I want him to introduce it, but to me, it's the contemporary maroon. Maroon is when you run away, period. When you don't make sense to your owners. When you don't make sense to your plantation owners. Maroon means incoherent to the plantation system, to racism, incoherent to oppression. It has no name, no language. You just bust out going, and nobody knows how to run. That's why they say he's a rogue, he's a maroon. The Spanish said he's a maroon, meaning he's a runaway, he's ungovernable. I'm glad he was or she was ungovernable. I don't want to be governable even now. I don't like from traffic lights to police states. So I'm impressed with these folks who just stole themselves, extricated themselves, says, I'm incoherent. From today on, I don't want to be coherent to the mainstream language, to the mainstream culture. I am incoherent because my name is rebellion. My name is the rebel. And this is what I like about this history. And thank you very, very much for coming, my brother, Professor Carr, for honoring us. I can't help it. He's a, you know, Howard University professor. Every student is crazy about him. I'm jealous. When, you know, no student values me. They go, oh, Gurima is crazy. Carr, oh, he's good. Carr is good. Even my son. He said to me, I'm going to take this class. I said, Johannes, this class, you know, the guy is like, I hear is socially relevant teacher. Are you going to be like socially relevant suddenly? He says, no, I like his lectures. I've heard him. Which means he went, he sat somewhere and spied if he wants to go in his class or not. What a nice way of like shopping around. At Howard, you shop grades. In my view, say, Gurima don't give A, so don't go to his class. This is how it's shop. But then my son said, I shopped around by sitting in the back, and I like him, I'm going to go to his class. So we're really lucky you are here at Howard, my brother. At least for my sons. Okay? So, my brother, I'm not going to say doctor. You got it. It's proven. White folks have accepted it. You are a chair of the African Studies Department at Georgia State. You have a whole lot of plantation workers for you. So I want to bring you and present your lecture, and then we'll have a question and answer and book signing at the end. Thank you very much, my brother, for coming.
Thank you, Baba Holly. How y'all doing?
Great.
Name our mothers, fathers, all our ancestors. I'd like to greet you all tonight. I'm a member also of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the New African People's Organization, so I like to say free the land.
Free the land.
Free the land.
Free the land.
By any means necessary. Ashe. I stood this way because I didn't want to block the images for y'all. Y'all all good, right?
Yes, sir.
This is a book I took a long time to work on. I probably would have been working more with Baba Holly on the Maroon Project, but I had to get this thing out, you know. And it was, those of you who've done books, you know, they're like babies. And as much as a man could have a baby, this was like a baby for me. Wasn't 9 months though. Took me a long time to do the research, a lot of persistence. Because I'm an activist, I'm a father, I'm a husband. So, you know, those folk took their time too, right? And so I'm not just the type of person that the only thing I do is research and I don't have other commitments in life. But now it's out and I'm glad to share this with you. Let me give you some of the roots of how this story starts for me. You see that place on the map, Alligator, it's actually Alligator Lake, Mississippi. That's where my daddy was born. Everybody's been asking me, are you from Mississippi? No, I grew up in Compton, California. Compton gets some love in D.C., okay. But I grew up in Compton. My father grew up in the Mississippi Delta. And he was a sharecropper, picked cotton. Didn't go to high school till he was like in almost 30, okay. He told me this story when I was a youngster. He said that one day from a water tower, they saw a black male body hanging. And my grandfather went and grabbed his rifle, and he was going to shoot the first white man that he saw. And the family tackled my grandfather and disarmed him. Now, I can't remember how old I was, maybe 11, 12, 13, I can't remember. When my father told me this story, but I had some ambivalent feelings. On one hand, you know, growing up in California during a period of time, we didn't hear about black people down south fighting back. You know, I grew up during the time when we saw the images of the water hoses and things of that nature, right? So I didn't really see that, so I didn't know anybody was willing to fight back. I didn't know the story I would find later as a researcher. On the other hand, I understood the fear that my father and the family felt. They were not just thinking my grandfather would have been killed. They were thinking the whole family would have been wiped out because that's how those terrorists rolled during that time, right? And so this is partially what this story is about because black people had to deal with a lot of fear. There was a lot of terrorism that was waged against our people. You know, Bin Laden didn't have nothing on these Klansmen, right? He didn't have nothing on these people in Mississippi, Alabama, and where I live now, Georgia. Georgia and Mississippi, y'all know, led the country in lynchings, when lynchings were common. So there was great terrorism that our people faced. So it caused a lot of fear and intimidation. Why did they feel like they had to come so hard on us? Y'all see the reddish color on the map. You might not be able to see it from there, but what the reddish color represents in 1880, they were counties where black people were anywhere from 78% to 92%.
Wow.
1880, right? Two decades, really 15 years out of captivity. And so if you want to maintain white supremacy, what do you got to do to keep these people under control? Terrorism is what happened. You know, you gotta, let me go back. Okay, they had to keep people under control, right? Because they had to keep people like my father on the plantation so they could continue to make super profits off of my ancestors, right? So they had to make sure also they didn't get political control. Not only did they just want to keep them on the plantation, but y'all know the story of Ida B. Wells in Memphis, Tennessee. Black men who were successful, that became a threat. Just the image of them being able to compete economically, right? So they tried to intimidate us at the ballot box. In fact, one of the first stories I have in my book is the story of a brother, Charles Caldwell, in Mississippi, who was a state senator. He also organized the black militia in the 1870s, right? And to protect Reconstruction governments. But you know, he was killed on the streets of Bolton, Mississippi in 1874 on Christmas Day. Okay, just murdered on the street. Again, that was a form of terrorism they engaged in against our people. I told you Mississippi and Georgia led the country in lynchings. They were common in American history during that time, right? Hundreds of them annually. Hundreds. It wasn't an exception. It was a part of American culture, particularly in the South. Okay, but one of the things I like to tell people, you don't see a lot of political activism in Mississippi during a period of time historians call nadir. Nadir is a period, I always thought that slavery was a low period. But when I started studying history, they said, no, it's the period of time after Reconstruction until the 1920s. I would say Mississippi up to the 1950s, though. I give it a reinterpretation for Mississippi. It's during the period of time when lynchings were common. It's during the period of time they institute Jim Crow, right? They institute apartheid in the United States, right? Okay? It's during the period of time when black life didn't mean anything. I mean, at least after the Middle Passage ended, you know, the Middle Passage ends in 1808, and during that period of time where they couldn't get a fresh supply of us, then even though they considered us property, they wanted to make sure their property lasts. But during this time, our lives were cheap and they would kill us in the hundreds. They weren't killing us in the hundreds like that during the period of time of our captivity, right? Y'all with me?
Yes, sir.
But during this time, our lives didn't mean anything. And they would use outright terrorism to keep us intimidated and afraid. But were we doing anything? How did we respond during this period of time? And this image to me represents, what were we doing? We're building community, right? We're building lodges. Y'all know what I mean by lodge, right? Not just I'm talking about a resort somewhere, but organizations of men, organizations of women, secret organization. Those organizations build businesses in our community, right? There are buildings in Atlanta during that time, though. I'm gonna turn this down a little bit. That's my man, Charles Mingus.
Yes, sir.
I don't wanna turn him off, I'm gonna turn him down.
Yes, sir.
There are buildings in the South, office buildings, that were built by the Masonic lodges and secret societies. They built churches, right? They built families, built our relationships. We built businesses during this period of time. We don't see a lot of political activism. When they started NAACP chapter, they run them out quick in Mississippi. We did build UNIA chapters. In the county my father was from, they built the Universal Negro Improvement Association. They had rallies of 1,000 people or so. But, you know, that was even a little bit challenging, right? But we built. Then by the 1950s, went a little too far, we established this organization in that same county, Bolivar County, Mississippi, built an organization called the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. Okay, how many of y'all heard of that group? Only a few of those are people really been studying. Regional Council of Negro Leadership. In the 1950s, they start organizing rallies. 10,000 people in the country. Y'all know rural area ain't supposed to be a big population, right? But from all this slow building over years, they were able to manifest this movement. Here's what Ebony Magazine said about this organization. Y'all see it? They see it today in Mississippi. This is 1955, or Dixie, excuse me. There is emerging a new militant Negro. He is a fearless fighting man who openly campaigns for his civil rights, who refuses to migrate to the North in search of justice and dignity, and is determined to stay in his own backyard and fight. That's Ebony in 1955 said that about this organization. Now, speaking to a black audience, y'all know the significance of Ebony in our community, right? I don't need to take away anybody's ghetto card here. Okay? So that's what they observe. Again, because they're having thousands of people come out. And at first, they thought they were what you call an accommodationist organization, because they just said, we want to get equality within segregation. But then they said, let's not buy gasoline where we can't use the restroom. Now, some people my age, y'all know the significance of that. Because when our families drove through the South, we needed to know where we could stop. You know what I mean? To eat, but even to pee, even to defecate, we needed to know where we could stop and do it in somewhat dignity, not have to take your children out to the back of the gas station when you know it's a restroom right there, right? So they said, don't buy gasoline where you can't use the restroom. Then they start saying, well, look, if we get the right to vote, maybe we can elect the first Negro congressman in the Delta in Mississippi. And that became threatening to people. It was headed by this brother here, T.R.M. Howard. And again, they thought he was an accommodationist. In 1946, those of you who are my age or older, you remember the Saturday Evening Post, right? Exactly. The Saturday Evening Post was one of the leading mainstream, if you like that word, I really don't, mainstream magazines. And they said that Dr. Howard was a credit to his race. Why did they say that? He built the first swimming pool for black people in Mississippi. Why do we need a swimming pool? Where did I say my daddy was from? Alligator Lake, Mississippi. In that county, you probably have more alligators than anywhere in this country, even including Florida. Not just where my daddy was from, but so black children are swimming in the pool, not just with alligators, but with rattlesnakes. So to have a place for our children to play, Dr. Howard built us a pool. He built us a park, the first park for black people in the state of Mississippi. And so white people say he's a credit to his race. He ain't trying to integrate with us. You know, he ain't trying to have his kids swim with our kids. That was all right with them. But then when he starts talking about don't buy gas where you can't use the restroom, that becomes subversive all of a sudden. He needed protection. So Dr. Howard, when I was first told about Dr. Howard, the person who told me about him said, oh, Dr. Howard, he was a gunman. He was a gunman. He always carried guns with him. In fact, you know, in Mississippi, gun laws are pretty liberal. It's not like D.C., right, or New York or somewhere like that. They're pretty liberal, but they try to disarm black people, particularly black leaders. So he had places in his car where he would hide the guns, right? They couldn't find them. He also had armed security. He could pay for it.
We were just listening to Dr. Akinyele Umoja in a discussion about his book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Struggle. And before him was the famed filmmaker, Holly Urima. We will now turn to a conversation on the theory and practice of the Black Church. I recently sat down with Dr. Torn Alexander, visiting professor of liberal studies at Winston-Salem State University, where we explored the deep epistemological and ontological underpinnings of the Black Church, paying particular attention to the differentiation of the Black Church as an institutional physical space and incubator of liberatory practice. Dr. Alexander is a scholar of African American religion and religious experience. His interdisciplinary research and teaching is influenced by phenomenology, critical theories on race and gender, and post-colonial, post-structuralist studies. Enjoy the program. Yes, I'm here with Dr. Torn Alexander, and we wanted to have a conversation, an in-depth conversation about the role and responsibility of the Black scholar, But we also want to look at it within the context of from a religious standpoint. And we're using religious very, very loosely. And the reason why I wanted to have this conversation is because in this state of time, in this socio-political moment right now, there's a lot of unrest. There's a lot of resistance. There's a lot of things going on in the world, in the African world, here in the United States, in the diaspora. And we wanted to have a conversation about the role and responsibility of one of the considered to be an important institution, which is the church. But we wanted to have a substantive conversation because we wanted to deal with the ethics and the philosophy of the Black church. And to have a conversation about this, let's get started here. What was the historical role of the Black church in the Black community or in the African diasporic community? If we can give that little bit of history and we'll move from there.
Okay. I think most scholars of African-American history or African-American religious history would say that the church was probably the first and most significant institution that, you know, developed out of the, you know, African-American experience in the United States, in the sense that it was really kind of the first institution that was or could be seen as their own. Now, I mean, there's, you know, some qualification about that just as far as the how the church developed and the early church and the distinctions between kind of the independent Black church movements and what, you know, took place in the South as far as, you know, kind of the slave religion and what scholars have often referred to as the invisible institution. But, you know, all of those different currents would, you know, kind of came together in and are under the rubric of what most people talk about when they think about the Black church. And so it's been the bed for, the kind of crucible in which leadership has developed, education has developed, social services have developed in the African-American community. And again, until probably fairly recently, I think if you think of leadership in the African-American community, invariably there is some kind of religious or church connection.
So that's very, very important. You talked about the leadership development. And you talked about it, the church developing out of the African diasporic experience here. What were some of those, let's push that a little bit further, what were some of the African cultural manifestations that we can find in the embryonic stage of the formation? And we're going at the beginning of the formation of the church, because is it safe to say that Africans did not bring the institutionalization of the church as we understand it today? They didn't bring that with them, but they brought some of the ethics and the ideas that were able to be meshed into the institutionalization of the church as we understand it.
Right. I mean, yeah, the institutional church was, you know, kind of gave a kind of a materialization, a concretization of certain things that I would say were, you know, part of the, came out of the African world, African understanding. Probably one of the best or writers on that, or one of the ones that I've often rely on, is Peter Parris's book called The Spirituality of African Peoples. And in that, he talks about in looking at kind of the African diasporic community and those, that portion of it that is found in North America, talking about kind of those things that kind of connect us in terms of kind of a worldview, spirituality. And several of the things he talks about that I would say are reflected and have been carried on in the institutional church are things like the understanding of community, the role of community, centrality of the family, things like that. On more of what might be a traditional spiritual or theological configuration is this understanding of that the then in some sense that all of reality is kind of imbued with the spiritual or the religious. There's not this kind of Western idea of, you know, kind of bifurcation of the secular and profane, that the divine, the sacred is imminent in the world, fully expressed in all that we do and all that we encounter. And so these elements, I think, are, you know, according to Paris, you know, are kind of commonalities amongst African peoples. And so when we look at the American context and Africans that were brought here, they bring, while, you know, some of the forms of religious worship and practice, you know, kind of are not able to be sustained, some of those kind of ethical, cosmological elements persisted and became, you know, found expression in, and it would eventually find expression in the context of these religious institutions that, that African peoples would create in the New World. And again, the most dominant example of that in the North American context is, would be what we call the Black Church.
You mentioned this, and you said something about the spiritual elements, those cultural, those deep-rooted cultural elements. How did that inform Africans in the diaspora, specifically in the United States, but then we can look at it within the Caribbean and also Latin America as well? How did it inform the idea of the human? How did and in relation to the community and also the responsibility of the social system within the context of rights? How did those things interrelate?
Okay, in context of the understanding of the human. That the human being is not some separate, individualistic, entity, but there is this, again, in the kind of more expansive cosmology, it is that the human being is a part of a whole, and that one cannot simply think of oneself as this kind of autonomous, independent agent, as you know, that we get that comes out of the kind of Western Enlightenment types of thinking. So there's this kind of, there's a sense of obligation, commitment, relationship that one has always to that, you know, more than just oneself. And again, this was reflected in institutions that were created in the New World by African peoples. There's always this push for, in the sense that, you know, that, again, of community, of relatedness, of connectedness, of a kind of a social concern and expression. Again, very much not that, you know, not this idea that we get in the kind of Western idea of that you're an individual, that you're autonomous, that you have agency, that you have the freedom to choose and do whatever you want. There is this social component, a social connection. That everything, in some sense, is connected, and that you're a part of this. So, again, things like churches are not just simply, were never just simply kind of a place that one goes and, you know, prays and sings. But churches, you know, were always places where there was this idea of service, of doing things for the community, of upliftment of the people, of, you know, of trying to better one's community. And it was seen as, you know, this kind of organic relationship between the community and the church. And that, I think, is different to some extent from, again, particularly the kind of the not so much the Western, but the Protestant notions and constructions of religion. Again, it's this kind of thing is just, you know, oftentimes very individualistic understanding of faith and one's relationship to God or the divine. It has always been this more expansive understanding in kind of the African-American context. And so, say, for example, when we look at the early expressions and involvements of African peoples, you know, in North America, particularly, let's say, in the context of, I mean, you can either go north or south, but, for example, in the north, let's just say the north, I mean, oftentimes the creation of these African independent church movements were preceded by the creation of organizations that, you know, advocated for, the African liberation. So the Free African Society, for example, that was founded, that started in Philadelphia by Absalom Jones and Richard Allen, that would, happen along with the creation of the what would eventually become the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And so there's in their understanding and their formation of the mission of the church has always been about the betterment of the African American community. Or you look at the sister church, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, that arose in New York, and they have this strong tradition as well. They often refer to themselves as the Freedom Church because people like Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass were all involved in that particular denomination, and that they have this sense of about being a part of the liberation project of African peoples. And this, again, was one of the characteristics. If you look in the South with, again, the idea of the invisible institution, you have these more often clandestine types of gatherings called in brush arbors and hush arbors. And it was a time for, you know, these African people to get away from the kind of gaze of the white establishment, white masters and slaveholders, and to be alone, and again, not just to worship in kind of a spirit of freedom, but to think through all kinds of things in a, again, spiritual, political, social, cultural kind of dynamic. And it's not surprising then that out of those meetings and gatherings, you have, you know, this link between those meetings and the early kind of insurrectional slave revolts. I mean, people like Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, all kind of come out of this kind of religious matrix, right? That you have in the South. So again, and there's not this disconnect between this liberation struggle actual trying to secure the physical material liberation of black people, but it's related to this, you know, kind of the religious spiritual sensibility. It's all of a piece. It's not separated.
So that's a very, very important point. You're talking about liberation, and you're talking about liberation holistically. You're talking about a physical material liberation.
Right.
But it's also a liberation of the spirit, of the connection with the divine, and also in the earthly cultural elements that we find in a lot of traditional African spiritual systems that have transplanted itself from the continent of Africa, but also in other parts of the diaspora. Let's push this point, and so the institution of the church is a little bit more than just the physical building itself, the brick and mortar. It's this space of a connection between what we probably call heaven and earth, mm-hmm. And that space of thinking. How does this relate to the black radical tradition? How did this liberatory space provide a fertile ground for individuals and also groups who may not have considered themselves a part of the black church to be liberatory?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, is an interesting, question in terms of, you know, the black radical tradition and its relationship to the church. I mean, Gayrard Wilmore, one of the kind of senior deans of kind of African-American religious thought and studies, his famous kind of seminal text, Black Religion and Black Radicalism, kind of talks about these phases that the church has kind of gone through. And again, what I was alluding to earlier, you know, this kind of radical tradition going, you know, of Prosser and Vesey and Turner and up, you know, in the 19th century up through the early part of the 19th century, before the Civil War, then subsequent, you've got these powerful figures. Earlier on, you've got people like Alexander Crummell and Edward Lamont Blyden, and people who are really kind of proto early kind of Pan-Africanists. You've got Henry McNeil Turner, you know, who was again an early bishop in the AME Church, who, you know, again in the late 19th century is talking about, you know, that God is black. And he's this really strong advocate for this kind of Pan-African perspective. And, you know, you've got a lot of these figures that, you know, again, kind of really dovetail, I think, well with a kind of a black radical tradition. But something that Wilmore notes in, you know, kind of post-Reconstruction, the era of Jim Crow, there seems to be a kind of a turn or different tack taken by the church, and it's this move, I think, for a number of reasons, towards a kind of respectability, this kind of acceptance of the American ethos, and trying to become a part of, to become really, really wholly American, and try to show that, in some sense, that out of after in the wake of slavery, that African Americans can be good citizens, they can be responsible individuals, they can kind of fit in society. So you get this kind of movement towards respectability, and again, Wilmore's assessment is this kind of move away from kind of this radical tradition. And we don't really, again, I mean, there's some question. I think that's definitely the case with the more mainline black church, those, again, the more independent black church movements, the Baptist, the Methodist.
And the African, I mean, they look to Africa for a certain level of understanding or connection. You talked about the Pan-African sensibilities.
Right.
Of these churches. You got the African Methodist, the Zionists,
right,
with AME, the AME Church, and things like that. So Africa was a sense, in a sense, had some type of connection to the building of the, they looked to Africa.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, definitely early on, I mean, that was part of their identity. It is, you know, very much this vision of an imagining of Africa, of, you know, of in an attempt to try and carve out and construct a sense of self, a sense of peoplehood, a sense of who they were. So yeah, it's not an accident that these, you know, in coming in the, you know, 18th century, that these independent black churches, you know, invariably, you know, refer to themselves as African Methodist Episcopal Church, African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, or in the case of, you know, early Baptist churches, you have First African Baptist Church in Savannah, Georgia, or in New York. This interesting looking at, you know, the Baptist, African-American or African Baptist presence there, and the creation of, you know, one of the early churches there, the Abyssinian Baptist Church. You know, there's all this effort to connect with Africa early on, and to say that we are, you know, this kind of African peoples, and that's very much a part of, you know, the early part of these church movements. What I was alluding to a little bit later, though, is in the sense of kind of invoking Du Bois, is there's this wrestling with this two-ness, you know, being African and American, and so we kind of have this again. Some scholars, like Wilmore, will say that we have this transition, you know, kind of post-Reconstruction, where there's more of an effort to kind of express their Americanness.
What were some of the factors that probably did Jim Crow?
Jim Crow? Yeah, exactly. Jim Crow. I mean, just the violence that was levied against, you know, the African American community. I mean, yeah, Jim Crow, segregation, lynching, just state-sponsored, supported violence. And, you know, and again, it's just, you know, there's this kind of, I think, for early on, coming right out of the Civil War in this period of Reconstruction, there was all this hope and promise. And then that when that didn't come to fruition, there's a kind of, well, what can we do? And, I mean, so you have this kind of, again, perhaps it can be categorized as a kind of a change in strategy of moving towards respectability to show Americans that we can be good citizens, that we are worthy of, you know, the rights. And
but the theology, the philosophy had to be different, though. The underpinning, the ethics of it was different.
Yeah, there's a development of, I'd say, of a kind of a different ethic. There is, again, this at least amongst these mainline groups of the kind of more radical expression is not really an option. That in some sense, again, it almost was, I mean, the language, you know, of the time prior to the Civil War and the way the Civil War was often viewed was in the sense of, you know, this was almost the Exodus experience for black people, and that we were finally going to be free. And then that didn't materialize. And subsequently, then it's kind of like, well, what do we do now? You know, what is or where is the promised land now? And so this idea of that, well, we've got to make the most of where we are now and to try and just acclimate ourselves, adapt, acculturate to, you know, kind of this, the American context. But, you know, and so you, I think you do have a lot of that, particularly from these mainline churches or the dominant, you know, kind of denominations. But it's not too soon after that that you start getting these kind of, you know, groups that might pejoratively be referred to as kind of cults or other, you know, really, but really are just kind of other religious expressions that begin to challenge that and begin to.
What are some of those? I mean, Garvey is in this particular moment.
Well, Garvey's,
you know,
yeah,
Garvey is in this moment as well. So
right, so you'll have the rise of Garvey. You'll have the rise of people that are oftentimes maybe viewed as kind of conservative, like Father Devine, you know. Then eventually you have the, you know, like the Moors, the Moor Science Temple, the Noble True Ali, and eventually you'll have the rise of the Nation of Islam. And they are offering a number of critiques. In some sense, they're offering a critique of kind of the dominant African-American Christian perspective, and as far as the doctrine as well as, you know, the institution of the church, and offering something else, and seeing the need for, again, these questions of identity and belonging and community, and again, not so often, you know, these kind of militant, you know, kind of expressions that we might associate, again, with kind of the earlier periods and slave insurrections and things of that nature, but an effort to really try and reach and minister and care for black people in the situation and circumstances that they're going through.
So there was something implicit in that. We did a history looking at a point, and so I'm hearing a lot of the turn from doing Jim Crow or doing that particular period after doing Reconstruction was a practical matter.
Right.
But also there were some implications for that, right? I mean, we have now today, and we're going to kind of push it up forward and looking at it today, because what is the role and responsibility of these institutions today? Because there's a lot of critique of the black church today of not being engaged in the black
right.
community, and definitely not being engaged in progressive or even radical
right.
Politics. I mean, but of course we have a very interesting origin a very radical origin, mm-hmm. A break from the institutionalization of slavery as that space of being able to talk to the ancestors, mm-hmm. Africanisms and things like that. How do we understand that today? How do we understand the church? Because, of course, you talked about leaders.
Right.
Right. So how do we understand that today?
Yeah. I don't know how we understand it today. I mean, in some sense, I think, you know, again, if we go back to Wilmore and his construction and talking about, you know, kind of where he saw a moment of reawakening of the black church, it was, not surprisingly, in the 50s and 60s, the civil rights movement. We have the, you know, certain figures, not just Martin Luther King, the SCLC and SNCC and a number of these organizations that come about and seem to be engaged in, again, the you can call it the black liberation struggle in this country. But, you know, even there, I think it's people may, you know, the assumption that, well, this was a kind of a complete reawakening of the radical tradition in the black church would be a misnomer. I mean, it was really not a minority of the black church that was really engaged in kind of that civil rights struggle. I mean, again, the institutional church, in large respects, had adopted this kind of accommodationist position. And, I mean, you know, in the case of King, he basically was kicked out of, you know, one religious organization, the National Baptist USA, and with some of his other with a group of younger clergy that had been more engaged in this kind of activism, founded the Progressive National Baptist Church. But so it was never, you know, the whole black church. So I think when we look at the contemporary context, we'd be misguided to think that there has been this huge damping down of radicalism, that radical...
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Matali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, and technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technologies. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC 90.5, a broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Until next week, be peaceful, be safe, and above all, be intelligent.
Matthew 6:33, read and believe in the book. Hallelujah, 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 prophet black Jesus.
Did you been baptized? Has you been baptized? Has you been baptized? Let the fish fry proceed.